You're listening to the Radio Book Club here at Community Radio KGNU Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. It's a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, and as always, my co-host is Arsen Kashkashian, who is the head buyer at the bookstore and who curates the book club. And this is such a perfect book club read because it's all about a bookstore and avid readers. Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore by Matthew Sullivan. We're delighted to have Matthew with us in the studio. And Arsen, tell us about this book, why you chose it.
Well, I chose it partially for the reason you said. I mean, it's a mystery that takes place in a bookstore. And there's just so much about reading in here and books. And I just thought it'd be fun. And not only is it a bookstore, it's a Colorado bookstore. It's based in Lodo down in Denver. Matthew worked at the Tattered Cover, so people can draw their conclusions from that.
Well, Matthew, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
This is the ultimate page turner. I think right from the beginning, you're completely drawn into this story. And it was just a wonderful read. I read this in two sittings, which is quite a feat, but I couldn't put it down. Thanks. And it really does have so many Denver elements. And it's set in Denver. There's flashbacks to, you know, a previous era because this, it is a mystery.
Yeah.
But tell us about your experience at the Tattered Cover and why you really use that as an inspiration for a setting for this type of mystery.
Sure, sure. So I worked at the Tattered Cover in the 90s for about 4 or 5 years. And it was, you know, I was in my 20s at the time. And I just found that kind of arriving at the Tattered Cover in the time that I did, and especially in the lower downtown store, which opened up when I was working there, it just had this kind of enormous impact on my life. It was just a really kind of exactly what I needed at that time. And so I guess the, you know, when, if I kind of break that down a little bit, part of it was that I had finished up as an undergraduate. And I had kind of gone out into the working world a little bit and lived in Buena Vista for a while, and ended up back in Denver and really kind of felt like my education was not at all complete. And I'd always been a reader and a bibliophile. And so just kind of arriving at the bookstore, being able to kind of get a job there and being surrounded all day, every day by books and by people who love books and by customers who were making a choice to kind of step into a store and be around books. It was just incredibly impactful. I really can't even touch on how meaningful it was for me at that time in my life and the impact that it had on me. And then, of course, I met my wife there. We were both booksellers together in the kids section, so the impact continued in so many other ways beyond just kind of the, you know, daily life of me as a 20-something.
Yeah, it's fun. I got to the Boulder bookstore when I was 26 and had a similar effect on me, and I'm still there. And, of course, I met my wife at the bookstore. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like it's almost a culture that is seems somewhat unique, bookstore culture, you know, that people who are in, some people are there for a long time, but people who just pass through, but everybody has this amazing interest in books. And what it means to be interested in books is to be interested in all sorts of different things, just that learning. People just want to continue learning, but maybe without the structure, it seems like, is what the bookstore culture seems to be about
me. You're an explorer. I mean, you really, and you're willing to set your kind of, the values that books represent, you're willing to put those kind of at the top of your life because that, not necessarily at the top, but it's your job. You're willing to kind of step in that direction and kind of adhere to those values on a daily basis. And that often means not making very much money. It often means kind of dealing, you know, inevitably in the retail world, which has its own struggles and so on. And so, but it kind of also, in such amazing ways, feeds into that exploration and that sense of discovery that you're talking about.
And you really talk about the relationship between the bookseller and the customer, the book buyer, but you use the term book frog, which I had never heard of before. Yeah. And these are a group of folks, and one in particular really sets the stage for this story, a very tragic suicide right at the beginning in the bookstore, and then all of that will be revealed throughout the book. But what is that term book frog? Is that something you came up with for this book, or is this something in bookstore, you know, vernacular?
No, this is something in Matt's bizarre imagination, like, you know, sitting at the desk and kind of reflecting back on you know, this block of time in my life and those experiences. It just, these characters kind of emerged. And of course, I think in part because of the neighborhood that the Tattered Cover was in, the thinly veiled Bright Ideas bookstore in Lower Downtown in the 1990s. It wasn't long before that that Lower Downtown was really Skid Row. And of course, it was changing and changing pretty rapidly and has changed in just so much since then. But I think that, you know, bookstores, like a lot of institutions like that, and I right now I teach at a community college, so I think of that as kind of some version of that, some equivalency to that, have kind of an open door policy, and I think tend to be much more idealistic than, you know, your average retail business. And so with those open doors, you have people coming in who maybe are a little bit more on the margins of society, struggling in different ways in their lives, sometimes economically, sometimes with mental health issues and stuff. But you also have people who really have just kind of chosen to immerse themselves in the world of books, and let other parts of their lives fall apart. And I really kind of fictionalized that. I didn't, you know, have this term. I wasn't calling people book frogs at the time. But when I thought about these characters through Lydia's perspective and her point of view, this image emerged, and that's where the word came from.
Well, Lydia is the bookseller in question, and she has a very close relationship with a lot of these characters, as book frogs, as you call it. But that is so interesting. I thought you wrote about them in such a sympathetic way, where I think people who are familiar with bookstores, and I don't know if this is an issue with the Boulder bookstore, but I know certainly Lodo Tattered Cover has been an issue. Libraries as well. Maybe just spaces that have books have in many ways become this refuge for people who have no other place to be in a public space and who have been excluded from other public spaces.
Yeah. And I think the idea of a refuge or a sanctuary is so important. And we're seeing variations of that now, politically, culturally, where certain kind of institutions are becoming sanctuaries, are becoming refuges. And I think Lydia as a character, because of her own experiences, maybe had more empathy and saw that if this bookstore could act as a sanctuary for her, then in my mind, she kind of turned this around and made something of it, so that she is making sure that others who also need a sanctuary are kind of being taken under her wing. So that's where that came from.
Well, interesting you used the word sanctuary, you know, that this book frog, this guy Joey, who she's become very attached to, he's only like 18, 19 in the book. The book opens with him hanging himself on the upper floors and Lydia discovering him, and that really kind of breaks through the sanctuary of the store in a way, like this terrible event could happen at the store, but also begins events for Lydia, because she is running too from her own horror from her early from her childhood. And so I thought it was an interesting way to get the story going. And, you know, that's kind of every bookseller's nightmare, to be honest, that something terrible would happen like that. You know, when you find, luckily nothing like that's happened in the Boulder bookstore. We've had people passed out in the bathrooms that have really upset our staff quite a bit. But it was an interesting precipitating event.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I see that again on Lydia's trajectory, or from Lydia's perspective. She had a kind of a relatively happy childhood. She was raised by a single father, but he was a librarian. So she basically spent most of her free time in a library. And then her best friend's parents ran a donut shop. So she really was splitting her time as a child between a donut shop and a library, which is kind of a dream come true for any kid. And then when she's 10 years old, this kind of awful event happens that halts that trajectory and really kind of disrupts her life. And she, you know, as she grows older, she manages to, again, kind of return to some semblance of peace when she gets a job as a bookseller and again enters that sanctuary. And you're exactly right that plot-wise, because this is a mystery, that sense of peace has to be disrupted. I mean, it's W.H. Auden, the poet, talked about mysteries as beginning in Eden, and then there's this event, this usually a murder, that disrupts that Eden, and that the entire book or the entire structure of a mystery is an attempt to return to Eden to find that paradise again. And so, of course, for Lydia, this is chapter one, suicide. It's disrupted in the rest of the book. She's trying to kind of find her way back.
Yeah, I mean, she's not quite in paradise though, when the book opens, as you find out later on, because she's kind of papered over what happened to her as a girl, mm-hmm. because she has a boyfriend that she lives with for 5 years. She's never told him about her past.
Right.
She hasn't reconnected with any of the people from her childhood when she moves back to Denver. So it really is a false piece. It's like,
yeah.
to bring her to complete reckoning with herself and maybe to come to peace, she can't really go on the way she is going, can she?
No, and I would even argue that in her situation, and this is kind of depressing, but there never will truly be peace, you know, after what has happened to her, because she's going to carry that with her for her entire life. So it's really just kind of a semblance of that, an attempt at that. And even at the end of the book, not to give much away, but the very last part of the book, in my mind, there's still, you know, even if she has found something, there's still this kind of, she still feels that same kind of scar, even if it's a little bit more subtle than it is early on.
She can start being emotionally honest with the people around her after what she's gone through with Joey.
Right.
So Joey kills himself in the store.
Yeah.
And there's a message for Lydia.
Yeah.
But it's done in a very literary way, let's say. Maybe you can tell our listeners, how does Joey, after his death, get his message to Lydia?
So this is a character whose entire world is defined by books, and so you know, it's kind of playing with that idea that we are the books that we read, and for him, the most appropriate way to do this would be to kind of cut out messages and to kind of encrypt who he really was in his own collection of books as a way to kind of open himself up to Lydia in a way that he couldn't in real life or in daily life. And so, yeah, the books are encoded. They're encrypted. He cuts out little tiny windows, and then Lydia discovers a way to kind of decipher those. I won't give that away, but she finds out a way to kind of decipher the little cutouts that he's left.
Well, it's such a clever plot device, and it really fits so well with the story. And Joey brings Lydia back to her past, this tragic, mm-hmm. tragic past that she had as a childhood. As you said, it was like her childhood interrupted by this murder,
right. I mean,
we can just say, but it was something that haunted the entire city of Denver.
Yeah, yeah.
Was this based on anything that happened? There was, I think he's called Hammerman in the book.
Yeah.
This man who came in and essentially, you know, massacred her friend's family.
Right.
But the entire city is terrorized. Yeah. Was there anything in Denver's history that you kind of touched on?
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was in eighth grade in 1984, I grew up in Aurora. My family bought a new house in Aurora in 1970. And my dad still lives in that house, actually. And not far from our home, in 1984, in the middle of the night, a January night, a man broke into the home of the Bennett family and murdered the mom and dad and one daughter and attacked a toddler as well. She survived. But three of the family members were murdered by a guy with a hammer, and he got away with it. And there was another murder that was connected to him that happened in Lakewood, I think a week or so before. And so when this happened, you know, in suburban Aurora, 1984, the kind of land of mini malls, not that, you know, I'd never been exposed to violence or shock or, you know, I wasn't like this clueless kid or anything like that, but it really disrupted me. And it disrupted, I think, everybody, anyone who was living in town at the time. And I think also because of my age, I was, you know, eighth grade, kind of in that awkward place between being a kid and being a teenager and trying to figure out adulthood and leaving innocence behind and everything. And this just, it scared the hell out of me. It was terrifying. And again, everyone I knew, people just kind of had this blank look on their face for a long time. And especially because the guy never got caught. Like, he's still out there. There was never any kind of justice there. So I didn't attempt it at all to kind of write about this. I was just writing about Lydia and the bookstore thing. And I knew that I wanted her to have something in her past. And as I was working on it, that's kind of the anecdote or the situation that emerged. And I didn't ever try to write about it as to shed light on the real case or anything like that. But I borrowed the killer and I borrowed some aspects of the situation. And I tried, really, most importantly to me, to kind of capture that fear and capture that kind of horror and that disruption that I was feeling as a kid in town. So, of course, that's nothing like people who were personally involved. But in a way, like, the entire city was personally involved, because all of us were, you know, looking at the newspapers and watching the evening news and hearing it talked about at school and recess and around the dinner table. And it was terrifying and it was awful.
In some ways, I still get choked up.
It's horrible.
It reminded me a little bit of the John Bedet Ramsey murder here, an unsolved murder that really just impacted an entire community. And I think the fact that it wasn't solved, the fact that a child is the victim of this in their own home.
And just, I don't know, to me it's, I see fiction in my own life and writing as a way of disentangling things. And I, and this is not always conscious, but when I look back at the stories, the work that I write, inevitably there's something that's kind of getting at me that I can't quite come to terms with in real life. And so I find myself fictionalizing, not like retelling, but disentangling it and trying to come to some kind of other terms with it, because I can't come to terms with it in my own life.
Do you think it was coming up maybe in some ways, because you're a parent now and you have two kids, you're seeing a different angle, maybe just subconsciously, and writing those, you really write that, you know, the book as a whole is not like some violent murder mystery or anything, but you do write that scene, 10 or 15 pages or whatever it is, is pretty graphic and pretty violent. And, how was writing that scene, and how emotional was that for you to try to imagine yourself in that house?
Yeah, you know, I think it was tough, but in some ways it was also kind of easy. I have to say, it was one of those scenes that I really just immersed myself in. You know, who is this Lydia girl at 10 years old, and what's her situation, and how would this unfold? And it just kind of, it was one of those situations, honestly, where very rare in a writer's life, where it felt kind of like I was in a little bit of a trance and it was just kind of coming out. And of course I rewrote it, but it was relatively easy. Like, a lot of other scenes were much, much more difficult than
maybe
that.
Because you've been imagining it since you were a kid. That's the nightmare that you've had in your head for all these years.
Yeah, I mean, it was coming out of this kind of emotional core, I think. Yeah,
we're speaking with author Matthew Sullivan this morning at KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore's Radio Book Club. His latest book is Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore. It's a bookstore that is a fictional bookstore. However, it is set in Lodo, Denver in the 1990s. And really, we're all just talking about the tattered cover at this point. And that's actually where Matthew Sullivan was a bookseller himself. It is a mystery, but there's so much more to this. There are so many layers of mystery because there's this murder that we've been talking about. But there's also the what happens to all these other characters in it as well. There are so many secrets that are revealed in people's relationship and different things with each other. But one of the things I just loved reading about was just Denver. Denver in the 1990s, and Denver then in Lydia's childhood, because there's a lot of flashbacks. And then there's this gas station / donut store that one of her best friend's parents owns that sounds like this wonderful Art Deco building. Is that an actual place? I mean, how realistic are some of these landmarks that you refer to quite frequently in the book?
They're realistic in my imagination, is how I would put it. So, you know, for the past 15 years, I've been living in Washington State and kind of rural Washington. And so I wrote this book when I was not living in Colorado, and my family is still here and I'm still back here often and so on. But I, the setting for me, a lot of that happened while I was not here. And so it's kind of my approximation of places as I remember them. And so Colfax Avenue, for example, where this gas and donuts shop theoretically exists, you know, my grade school is just a couple of blocks off of Colfax. My high school is just a couple of blocks off of Colfax. And I lived in Capitol Hill through my 20s and so on. So Colfax has just been this kind of like strand through my life. And so a lot of it was just kind of drawing on my memories, but my memories as filtered through the creative process. You know, gas and donuts, I drove past this donut shop that was on Colfax almost every day for many years of my life that had a big giant donut kind of, you know, up above. And everybody knows, you know, if you go out on East Colfax, certain kinds of gas stations where you go in and it's like there, it's a gas station, but they also have this amazing fried chicken, you know, and that kind of thing. So that's kind of what I was drawing on, but not any literal place.
I always wonder about that with writers when you're writing about a specific place, particularly one place that you grew up in and you have a real attachment to. Do you feel you can either be incredibly realistic, in which case you've got to be very historically accurate, or mm-hmm. just like, you know what, this is just a complete imaginative setting imposed on this real city.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think somewhere in between, actually, you know, there's no question. I think if you're spending years and years and years living in a place, those places kind of implant, you know, in your imagination or in your memory. And so that there is a reality, there's a basis of reality. But it's also, you know, I was just kind of thinking about this recently. When I consider the setting of this story, I was spending more time with the setting of this story sitting in at my little desk in Ephrata, Washington, than I was in Denver or Colorado at the time. So I was spending, you know, weeks and weeks and months immersed in this setting and spending less time actually being here, even on those visits. So kind of an odd, again, a creative aspect of that.
But sometimes maybe you need some distance to see a place clearly, or sometimes you need, mm-hmm. I think our previous person on the show, David Hicks, talked about he needed a distance of time to see the events in his life clearly, mm-hmm. to write about them in a certain way. And maybe that's true of a city even.
Yeah, you know, that's been my pattern. I tend to write about places where I used to live, and I've hopped around quite a lot in my life. And I'm not sure, I think I would have written this book anyway, but I think it would have been radically different if I was living in Denver at the time that I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think you would have gotten hung up on those details to go, that's not where that is, and I gotta include this?
Yeah, or there's an element of nostalgia. You know, Colorado is my home. It's such a strange place to be in my life to think of Colorado as my home. Yet I haven't lived here for almost 20 years now. And so I think that there's an element of nostalgia and even idealism, even in the parts that are like kind of seedy and so on. There's still an idealism to that. Maybe it's just kind of my own longing for a place that where I no longer live that enables, you know, in my mind, enables to the setting to kind of come to life.
That's author Matthew Sullivan joining us at the Radio Book Club here at KGNU, a collaboration between the Boulder Bookstore and KGNU. My co-host, as always, Arsene Kashkashian.
Well, we were talking a lot about settings, and these characters, Joey is an orphan. He has spent some time in jail. Lydia had this childhood interrupted where then she was spirited away to this tiny mountain town. But their real home seems to be within books and reading. And I was hoping you could read a passage that kind of illuminates this, and we could also hear part of the book.
Sure. Joey pulled a small hardback out from the crook of his arm and placed it between them on the counter. A Universal History of the Destruction of Books, a title that had been relegated to the depths of the bargain shelves where most of Joey's books came from. What do you think it's worth, he said, a book like this? Lydia spun the book in her hand quite expertly and looked at the barcoded label on the back. Though brand new, the book had been marked down and down and was now selling for a whopping 48 cents. Depressing. Looks like a really good deal, she said. Joey flattened his palms on the wooden counter. His hands were long and skinny, scarred across the knuckles, but soft. I mean, what's it worth, not what's it cost. Lydia stared at him, trying to measure his intent. She took a tiny step back. I guess it just bugs me to be paying so little, he added. Something's wrong in the air, you know, when a book costs less than a bullet or a Coke. Values-wise. Lydia sighed in agreement. Joey touched the book between them, a gentle finger tap. These things save my life, he said, in nearly a whisper. That's no small thing. You're not alone there. See, people say that all the time, but for me, they really did. Joey pulled off his hat and wrung it between his palms as if it were a washcloth. His eyes appeared so green against his bronze skin and dark eyebrows that they seemed to glow from behind, as if hollowed from jade. He was a beautiful boy. I don't know what I would have done without reading, he said. My whole life, really, but especially in prison. You know I was in prison, right?
Well, that passage is music to the ears of a bookseller. You know, first of all, you know that a book can't be worth so little as 48 cents and books saving people's lives. But, you know, for people who are desperate, you know, sometimes they really do rely on books in that way. And that's kind of the romance. We talk about being a bookseller. That's kind of the romance that book selling has, and you go into work every day and you think, you know, maybe I can really make a difference in somebody's life in a way that a lot of other jobs don't give you the chance to do.
Yeah, yeah, sure. There's a there's an element, obviously, of connection. And from a bookseller's perspective, you know, the standing there and talking to someone about a book or getting recommendations or just sharing the way that a book has impacted you with someone else, it's a point of discussion, and it's a point of kind of, you know, really kind of human and in a way kind of old-fashioned interaction. There's no app involved, you know what I mean? And I think that indies in particular, you know, all bookstores and libraries and so on, but I think indies in particular seem to set out to kind of foster that level of interaction and that level of connection between people. And, you know, books are just artifacts, right? But they're not just artifacts. They mean so much more. And so anyway, sharing that and discussing that and interacting around them is obviously like deeply, deeply meaningful to us book lovers. Yeah.
So in that passage, Joey talks about his time in prison. Mm-hmm. And through his time in prison, he ends up, we find, he was imprisoned in the same small town where Lydia had spent part of her life. And I was wondering, as a writer, and you're writing a mystery, and you have these pieces that you're trying to put together, and you want to try to read the lead or some reader somewhere, but you don't want to give the whole thing away too early.
Yeah.
How do you play with the coincidences or the little clues that you see throughout the book, you know, because that's a big piece.
Yeah, you know, there's an element of contrivance, I think, inevitably, if you're plotting, because, you know, not that interactions or connections, places where characters' lives overlap, don't happen in real life, because they do. But as soon as it becomes a narrative, then you run the risk of contrivance. And so I think, to me, it's always a question of, in this book, is this believable? In Lydia's world, could this make sense? And so, yeah, some of it would be contrived, I think, even as the writer, I think. But also, there's a point where there's a willingness to say, yeah, I'm good with that, given the world that I'm creating. That's okay. And so, in terms of the plotting, and especially a mystery, I kind of came at mysteries as a literary writer. Like, most of my short stories and a lot of the work that I've written before this is just kind of more literary. I'm coming out of the MFA world and, it, you know, kind of experimental, but still on the character-driven, more than plot-driven, kind of in that genre. And so, you know, from a plotting perspective, it was really difficult for me to kind of figure out how to dole out little bits and pieces and little breadcrumbs along the way to keep the momentum going and keep the pace going while still, in my mind, making this a character-driven book.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a real challenge. And this book took me a long time to write and a long time to get right. And so I, you know, at one point it was 600 pages long. There was this whole other 200-page kind of plot line that had to do with Raj when he was a kid and some things that had gone on with him. And I was really married to it. And my editor, bless his heart, stepped forward and said, you know, Matt, what do you think this book would look like without those 200 pages if we just kept it? You know, he said, you know, it's complicated enough. You've got a lot going on here. You got a lot of layers. What would this look like if we pulled that out? And my first reaction, of course, was no way. That's like, I'm married to that. That's my heart. And but then once I entertained the idea of it, I saw these things clicking together that hadn't clicked together before, which is why he was asking me that question. Mm-hmm. And so I took the advice and cut it out. And in my mind, the story was served, which is always what it's all about. It's not about my attachment. It's about, you know, how does this serve the story?
Well, I think the pacing is very good. I enjoyed it. And Maeve said earlier how, you know, she read it in two sittings. So I think the pacing is very good. And I think if you're coming from a more literary bent, maybe you have those extra 200 pages. But in a literary novel, you can't be as concerned with pacing as you are here.
Right.
Is there a moment in the book? I don't want to give it away. But is there a moment in the book where you feel like, okay, I've given enough. The reader should be able to figure it out. Where do you think the reader should be in the dark until you kind of really spell it out at the end? I always wonder that with mystery authors. You think, now this is where most of them should have it.
Yeah, so this was a real challenge for me, not coming at it from a mystery perspective necessarily. When I think about that moment, I kept thinking, you know, readers are going to figure this out and in 100 pages, they're going to know. And I would talk about that with my wife and other readers and talk about it with my agent and editor. And they said, no, I think you're so close to it. You're seeing the solution to this everywhere. And even, you know, I go back through it. I'm like, the answer to me is really obvious how all of these things fit together. But when I take a step back and imagine just kind of walking in blind, most readers have said they didn't really figure it out toward the end. Now, some mm-hmm. have. Some said, you know, midway through, I knew, you know, who the killer was. But hopefully, in my mind, they're reading it for other reasons.
Well, the book is Midnight at the Bright Ideas Bookstore. The author, Matthew Sullivan, joining us at the book club. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And as always, we look ahead to next month. And on February 22nd, we're going to be joined by another local author, Finn Murphy. He's actually right here in Boulder. And his book, The Long Haul, is what we're inviting listeners to read along with us in February.
Finn is a local guy who's a trucker. And his job was really to do kind of high-end moves. And he told a lot of stories. This book originally started with him talking into a tape recorder and about the stories about the people he met, about the trucking business, about his observations. He's just a wonderful storyteller. I think our audience will enjoy hearing him.
That's going to be February 22nd with Finn Murphy. In the meantime, you can listen to the interview we did with Matthew Sullivan. It's on iTunes as part of a podcast, and also tune into the After Hours at the Radio Book Club podcast, where we explore more of the ideas that we touched on. Thank you so much for listening. Arsen Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, as always, is my co-host. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU.